Shalom Havarim. Hello, friends. They let me play with the sound system again. So. I hope everyone is doing well. You are an energetic bunch. All right, that one day of school must have been too much for you this week. I see some tired. I don't know about you folks. It's been a weird week, and I've heard some weird stories. I even heard the story this week. Maybe you heard this as well. Did you hear about the guy who had an epiphany while he was getting dressed for church? No, you didn't hear about the guy who had an epiphany? It turns out he became a changed man. No? Okay. Did you hear about the woman who had an epiphany in a U-Haul? Oh, it was a moving experience. Yeah, well, it's good to see you on this day when we celebrate the end of the Christmas season. January 6th was the 12th day of Christmas. It's traditionally the day when you are to give your true love 12 drummers drumming. Anybody get 12 drummers drumming? Not even one drummer drumming. Okay, sorry. You did not have the ideal Christmas. But this is the traditional end to the Christmas season. 12 days after Jesus' birth, we celebrate the end of the Christmas season. Now, we give that a special name. Does anybody want to guess what the name of that end of days of Christmas, the 12 days of Christmas. Anybody want to guess what we call that day? Anybody at all? We sometimes call we call that Epiphany. And today we are celebrating the Epiphany, and we are doing so by bringing gifts to Mary and Joseph and baby Jesus. And just a reminder, as some of you have already done, we are collecting items to give to families that are in need. And I just want to say, I saw who brought it in, so I will draw attention to them and embarrass them. Danny and Francis, you even brought yours in gift bags. That was awesome. All these items will go to the Valley Mission. We are having this baby shower for, I don't even know what I was going to call them by their last name, the what family? The baby Jesus family. So Epiphany, it's a weird word that we don't use too often, but we kind of know what it means. I mean, I noticed that not everybody laughed at my first joke. So it must mean that you don't really use this word real frequently. So epiphany is simply a word. It comes from a Greek word, which is like epiphaneos or something like that. Won't make you say it. I know it's still early. But epiphany simply means an appearance or manifestation. Sometimes we describe an epiphany as a revelation. It's one of those things where you it's not like something just came out of the blue and showed up to you. It's more like it was always right in front of you. But only now, after somebody pointed out to you what was going on, or after you looked at it with a new set of eyes or from a fresh perspective, only then was it revealed to you this thing that was right there all along. I realized this week, you know, the last book of the Bible is Revelation. Thank you. And the word revelation simply means it was revealed. Like, oh, yeah. That's an epiphany. Epiphany was actually a word that was used by the ancient Greeks, and it was often used to refer to the dawn of a new day. When the sun would first pop up on the horizon and shed fresh light on the world that was always there, the world that was always before these people, this fresh light was shown, and they said it was an epiphany, because you were seeing it as if for the first time, seeing it anew. Now, I tried to come up with some more contemporary ideas of how we might experience epiphanies. And I came up with that common meme. And maybe some of you have seen these memes. Maybe you don't even know what a meme is. But you've seen these pictures online, and they say things like, I was today years old when. It's usually when something was like right in front of your face the whole time, and it wasn't until somebody pointed it out that you realized, oh, now that makes sense. So like, how old were you when you realized this? I was today years old when I realized that. So here's just a couple. I was today years old when I realized they call it video footage because film on a reel used to be measured by the foot. I didn't know that until I read it the other day. That was new to me. Or how about this one? This one kind of floored me a bit, and it's so simple, yet it really shocked me. This one says, I was today years old when I realized the symbol for division is simply a fraction bar with a placeholder for the numerator and the denominator. Like, yeah, exactly. I saw some minds blown out there. So like put 4 over 2, 4 divided by 2 is, or 4 halves is, 4 halves is 2. So this was an epiphany for me. I had never thought of it like that. I'm not sure if it was designed that way, but it seems pretty obvious now. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. These are epiphanies, things that were always right before our eyes, but they weren't realized until somebody pointed them out. It wasn't realized until new light was shone upon it. So we use this word to describe the arrival of the wise men. When they came to Jesus and they bowed down before him, they gave him gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And in this event, we see things anew. This wasn't just some baby born in a manger in a small city to these unimportant people. This was the birthday of the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. And I saw this picture. It's maybe a little awkward and doesn't show up real great on the screen. But if it was a modern day arrival, if the Magi would have come today, this might have been the scene as they walked into Bethlehem. And if you can't tell what's going on there, the Magi are taking rapid tests. Obviously, you all have never had rapid tests. Okay. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at this event. We're going to look at some of the background. We're going to look at some of the history. We're going to talk about what actually happens in the text and what is kind of just cultural or historical, what is believed about it, but maybe can't be backed up. And I'm hoping that we can have a bunch of mini epiphanies. If you need to do the mind-blowing thing throughout, that's fine. We're going to talk about some of the historical things or the things that we think are traditional that we've been taught all our life. And I'm going to try to maybe debunk some of those because some of them maybe aren't as historical as we might like to think. And then we're going to move into what we actually can get from the scripture and what the point might actually be. So again, we're going to kind of be all over the place. For those of you that have some problems staying focused, a little ADD, you don't have to raise your hands. I know you, by the way, the fact that you're not looking at me right now. If you have problems staying focused, we're going to jump in and out a lot with a bunch of little epiphanies along the way. And it's not going to be the most practical sermon, but hopefully you can learn something today and take something home from this as well. All right, so let's start by asking some questions of this text. Why is Epiphany celebrated 12 days after Christmas? Well, I asked this question of myself as I was preparing for today. Why is Epiphany celebrated January 6th, and why do we do it then in the church, you know, the following Sunday? We call this Epiphany Sunday. Why do we celebrate Epiphany 12 days after Christmas? So of course, I did some intense research, and I went to the almighty, all-powerful, omniscient Google, which never lets me down. Except for this time, because I searched for, you know, why do we celebrate Epiphany 12 days after Christmas? And they said on the almighty Google, and if you haven't picked up on it, I use that like sarcastically. This Google told me we celebrate Epiphany 12 days after Christmas because that's when the wise men arrived. Okay, there's nothing in the text that tells us the wise men arrived 12 days after Christmas. So I did a little more research. I went through a couple commentaries, you know, actual real research where it involves turning pages. And I couldn't find a good answer for why we celebrate Epiphany 12 days after Christmas. Why is there a 12 days of Christmas? Other than, you know, somebody invented it to write a song? No, that doesn't make sense. The best thing I could come up with is that 12 is a very symbolic number in the Bible. We know in the Old Testament there were 12 tribes of Israel. In the New Testament, there were 12 disciples. And my guess is that somebody came along and said, hey, why not 12 days of Christmas? Well, we know that the likelihood that they actually showed up on January 6th, you want to guess the odds? Boom. You've been to church here before. There is a 1 in 365% chance, 1 divided over 365, that they actually showed up on January 6th. Even less of a chance on a leap year. And actually, when we do some more research, you look at the context in which this is written, it's very likely that the Magi, the wise men, didn't show up for another 2 years after Jesus' birth. Remember the story that after the wise men come and they have this vision after they meet Jesus, they are not to go back to Herod to tell him where they found the one born, the Christ. So they go home a different route. And we have the story of Herod killing the innocents at the end of Matthew chapter 2. Herod sends his soldiers out to kill every boy age 2 and under in the city of Bethlehem. So I did this kind of epiphany movement. Did you see that? We find this in verse 16 of Matthew chapter 2. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious and gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. So the reason he killed all the boys under 2 years of age is because the star appeared 2 years before that. Now, it's actually possible that the Magi left 2 years before Jesus was born, and they traveled to Bethlehem. You know, even before Jesus was conceived, you know, they started off on this trip. But it seems more likely that they came after he was born. It may not have been a full 2 years. It might have taken some time after they left before Herod said, "Hey, I've been duped." But it was a big gap of time. So it might have been as much as 2 years later before the Magi show up. It might have been January 6th. Year 2 before they got there. And of course, it might not have been January at all. So we don't know why we celebrate Epiphany 12 days after Christmas, but we do, and that's fine. All right, the next question, where are they from? Tradition tells us that these men come from Europe, Asia, and Africa. Have you seen any depiction of the wise men before? Like if you have a nativity scene in your home, at least one of those wise men is probably a little bit darker in color. And here's just a scene from some random movie. I don't even know what it's called or where this is from. But when I Googled, again, pictures of the wise men, the first thing I found was a picture of Stanton Mennonite Church. The second picture I found was this one. And you see that there are people of different ethnicities and different backgrounds. This person may be Asian, or maybe European. This guy in the middle looks a little more Indian. The guy on the far side looks like he's from some African nation. So tradition tells us that they came from Europe, Asia, and Africa. And also within tradition, they are given names. Extra credit to anybody right now that can name the wise men. Ooh, Marlene. Got one? Casper, Melchior, and Balthazar are the names that are given to the wise men. Now, Danny read to us from Matthew chapter 2, the story of the arrival of the wise men. And does it say anywhere in there what their names were? Does it say which countries they came from? No, but you know what? I actually like this tradition. I like to think of them as coming from diverse places and coming from different backgrounds, different continents even, and coming together to worship Jesus. We aren't given their names. We aren't given their location of origin. All we know is they came from the East. And if you go far enough around East, you end up in the West. So we don't even know. The earth is round. All right, so we don't know what their names were or where they were from. How do we know they were men or even kings? So this, of course, it's not an original joke, but you've probably heard this before. We know that they weren't women. Or sorry, we know that they weren't men. You know how we know that they weren't men? Because they stopped for directions. And I realized as I wrote that joke down that nobody under the age of 18 will get that joke anymore. And because you've never lived in a world without GPS. And that my son's up here like, it used to be that men had this traditional, I don't even know what you call it, stereotype that men would not stop for directions. That's why it's funny. If you have to explain it, it's not funny. So we know that they were women because they actually stopped for directions. Actually, no, the flip side of that joke is, you know what? We know that they weren't women because if they were women, they would have brought diapers and casseroles and formula, practical gifts. But the reason that we call them men, well, first of all, we know there's more than one because the word is plural in the original text. And the reason we call them wise men is because that's what the King James Version calls them. I grew up reading the King James Version. That's what I was taught as a young man. And that's how King James chose to translate the word magos from the Greek into, actually they would have translated from the Latin, but they translated this word into English as wise men. Now, I don't have a problem with that translation. I probably usually refer to them as wise men because I think they were wise men. I mean, think about how they navigated all the way to Jesus. They followed a star. They left their country, went out and followed a star in the sky, and they came to the wrong place. But let's be honest, they were only 6 miles off where they were aiming for. And if I tried to follow a star to get to, you know, the next city, if I tried to go to Harrisonburg just by following the North Star, I would probably end up out, you know, West Augusta or something like that, totally lost. I couldn't do it. So they truly are wise men. But also, many people have pointed out, if they were traveling in the first century, it's very rare to find just three guys traveling by themselves, especially because they were well-to-do people. We know that they were wealthy because of the things that they brought for gifts. So it was more likely that they were traveling with an entourage of some sort. So it may have been these men traveling with women and even children as well. But of course, if they were really wise men, they would leave the children at home because nobody likes to travel with children. I love my children. Just not in the car. All right, so what else do we have? Kings, kings. We, of course, know that they're kings. How do we know they're kings? We don't. Actually, what happened is hundreds of years later, people are scouring through the Old Testament, and they're finding references that they think could apply to this event. And Isaiah 60, verse 2, is one of the texts that's in our lectionary for Epiphany Sunday. And Isaiah 60, verse 2 says this: "Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn." Well, somebody read through this and said, oh, obviously that light is a reference to the star. This is a reference to Epiphany, and this is a reference to the wise men arriving, and they obviously were kings. Maybe, maybe not. So I have this list of things that could or could not be true. I don't know. Why is Epiphany celebrated? Why do we celebrate Epiphany on the 12th day after Christmas? Jesus may have been born on January 6th. Where were they from? Well, they may or may not have been from Europe or Asia or Africa. What were their names? I don't know. Ted, Frank, Louis? Could it be any of those? That's probably less likely than Melchior and Balthazar and all those. And how do we know that they were men or kings? We don't. But the reason I bring all this up is it's cutesy stuff. Like, it's fun to depict them in such a way. But it's also somewhat helpful for me, formative-wise, to think of them as rich, powerful people from diverse backgrounds. And they all come together for one central purpose. And that purpose is to worship the one born King of Kings, Lord of Lords. So if it's helpful for you to think of Epiphany happening every year on January 6th, no problem. If you want to learn those names, obviously I didn't take the time to learn them, but if it's helpful for you, please do so. So what I want to do now is move from what we don't really know to what we do know. So what do we know? We know there are how many wise men? Tell me, Duncan, what's the reason? Right. It never says that there were three people. It says there were three gifts. And I imagine, you know, I'm going to be that guy because I'm so cheap. Like, I'm traveling from another country to go visit this baby with my three best friends. And we show up And my first friend's like, ooh, gold for you. The second one, frankincense. The third one, myrrh. And I'm like, nobody said we were doing gifts. Like, can you put my name on that card? Like, we don't know how many there were. Maybe he got multiple golds and multiple frankincenses. Frankincenses? We don't know. But what we know is what Duncan said for us. We know that they brought three gifts. And that's why they're usually depicted as three wise men. And let's be honest, if you saw four wise men in a stable or a nativity scene, you'd probably feel a little off about that, wouldn't you? Tradition tells us three wise men, but we don't know. And also, since I'm trying to keep it a little bit light, I came across this one this week. I know that's a little washed out. It says, right, we've picked up the gold, the myrrh, and what on earth is that? All right, so we know that they brought these three different gifts. And there's different interpretations as to why they brought these three gifts. Because let's be honest, I mean, Christmas was just a couple weeks ago. Kids that are here today, how would you feel about getting some myrrh for Christmas next year? You want something? I got one thumbs up from Sarah Dell. How about some frankincense? Maybe some gold. How about that? No, these are like terrible gifts. Like, who wants frankincense and myrrh? Who knows what frankincense and myrrh are? I mean, the last time I gave myrrh to a baby, like, they just wasted it. So it's a terrible, like, no, that's not even, that doesn't make sense. These are not gifts for a child. So there's different theories and different interpretations as to why the wise men chose to give these gifts. And I'd also say they must be important because Matthew makes sure to include these gifts in the text. Like, why would Matthew write this down if they weren't important? I mean, like I said, Christmas was 2 weeks ago. I mean, I've already forgotten some of the things that I got for Christmas. But Matthew wants to make sure that this lives in perpetuity, one word to say. These live throughout time, that we know generation after generation what was given. So here's some different theories as to why these gifts were given. And as you've heard before, I think Paxton just referenced this, there's the finance their time as refugees theory. And I'm naming these. These are not official titles for these theories. That's my name for them. So if it doesn't sound as polished as it should, that's why. Because I had kids home all week from school. The finance their time as refugees theory. This is the one that simply says, these are expensive gifts, like gold. Even to this day is a very valuable material. Frankincense and myrrh, even though we don't use a lot of those, we know that they are valuable. So the idea was that Mary and Joseph could have then taken these items and sold them. And that they were leaving for Egypt. We talked about Herod putting out this hit on all these children age 2 and under. Well, Mary and Joseph were political refugees. And they could have used that money to finance their time in Egypt. It's really expensive to pick up everything and just go to a different country. It'd be hard for Joseph to find work in a different place where he couldn't speak the language and didn't know people. So this theory says Mary and Joseph became the first ones to return a gift and take the cash instead. They were the first re-gifters or people that returned their presents, and they used that money to finance their way. And I would say that even if this wasn't the magi, the wise men's intention, that this is probably what they did, because myrrh and frankincense were a lot more valuable to them when it was liquidated, when it became cash, than to actually have it on hand. So there's something to that. I think there's some validity to that theory, but I'm not sure. Well, I won't get, might as well. Okay, so do you think the wise men really had that in mind when they came and brought the gifts? I think that's not as likely. Then there's the symbolic theory. I like this theory a little bit better. And this theory says that each one of those gifts was given because of who Jesus was. Who Jesus was and who Jesus was going to be. For instance, gold is a gift for a king. So in bringing gold to Jesus, they were recognizing that he was royal in some sense. Frankincense, that weird word. If you just take frank off incense, frankincense, what do you get? Incense, thank you. Frankincense is actually named in the Old Testament. It was an incense that was used in the Jewish temple in part of their worship practices. So frankincense, I say, was a tool of a priest. It would have been burned in their regular worship services. So frankincense could be symbolic of saying that either of two things, or maybe both of two things. It could be recognizing Jesus' role as the priest, who is the mediator between God and humanity, or it could be simply recognizing Jesus' own divinity. So there's the frankincense aspect. Myrrh was used as an oil to anoint the dead. If we read the Easter story, on Easter Sunday morning, the women go to the tomb to do what? You remember what they're going there to do? They're going to anoint the body. That's because back in those days, back before they embalmed, these bodies got pretty stinky. It's true. Remember the story of Lazarus. Lazarus has been in the tomb for a couple of days, and they don't want to roll away the stone in the front. And they have one of my favorite verses in the King James Version is, they don't want to roll it away because he stinketh. Right. So myrrh is used to anoint the bodies so that as they decompose, there's less smell. This may have been a understanding of Jesus' role in death and dying for our salvation. So this way of looking at these gifts simply says each one shows something about who Jesus was, who he is, and who he always will be. Let's do one more. The care for the carers theory. The care for the carers theory says that each one of these gifts was given so that it would help those who are providing care for Jesus. Think about it like this. You're Mary and Joseph. You're like a young man and a teenage girl, and you've just been put in charge of raising the Christ child. No pressure. They need a little care themselves. They need some help along the way. So you look at gold. Again, gold is useful. It is valuable. It is money. But in the first century, these items, frankincense and myrrh, were used for medicinal purposes. Now, it's kind of a quasi-science, even to this day, but you can still go out and buy myrrh and frankincense in like an essential oil to treat the body. Again, I'm not recommending this. You know, please consult your medical advisors before using this or any other supplement. But you can go to Walmart right now and buy yourself some frankincense and myrrh oil. Now, it's very popular in countries like China, even to this day, to use these for aches and pains. Frankincense and myrrh are said to have analgesic and anti-inflammatory as well as antiseptic properties. Analgesic and anti-inflammatory and antiseptic properties. Analgesic simply means it's a pain reliever. Anti-inflammatory, when your muscles get all inflamed from the stress, and antiseptic. Was there anybody in that story you think could have used an analgesic, anti-inflammatory, and antiseptic? Well, I think Mary probably could have used that. Like, here we are in the first century. She's just traveled into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey and given birth in a stable. There's some reasons for some antiseptics. She just gave birth in a time, well, like hundreds of years before the first epidural. There's some reason for an analgesic. So this concept says these gifts were given to care for the carer. Which one's right? I don't know. Maybe none of them. But I think all of them have a little truth to them. And holy cow, am I ever going to take a long time today. It's not a lovely day out there. You nowhere to go, right? All right. We need to shake it out a bit. I'm halfway through my notes. Let's stick with it. Okay, now let's. I'm further along than halfway. I saw everybody look back at the clock. All right, so I always want to come back to the question, what was the author's purpose? Why was this included in the text? And often we talk about Matthew's gospel as being the most Jewish gospel. Have you heard me say that before? Is the most Jewish gospel. It was written to a Jewish audience for the purpose of introducing them to the one who is born, the Messiah. So if you read through Matthew's gospel, you find the most references to the Old Testament, especially the prophets. Time and time again, Matthew is drawing from these Old Testament passages and say, see this over here? This is how it connects to this event over here. Now, one of the things that Matthew is very clear to point out is that Jesus is the new Moses. Let's look at some of the examples why Jesus is seen as the new Moses. The first is that they both come out of Egypt. We know that Moses was the one who led the Hebrew slaves out of captivity when Pharaoh was putting them to work, making them build these bricks, even bricks without straw. Moses led them out of that captivity. And we follow our story today with that story of Herod killing the innocents and Mary and Joseph and baby Jesus going down to Egypt. And Matthew will quote Hosea 11:1, which says, "Out of Egypt I called my son." So both Jesus and Moses are shown to have come out of Egypt. Okay, well, so are a lot of other people. Let's keep going. Both survived the genocide of the Hebrew boys. I mentioned the story about how Jesus' parents had to leave because Herod put this hit out on two-year-old boys and under. Well, remember the story of Moses is quite similar. When the Hebrews are getting so numerous and powerful that Pharaoh becomes scared that they might overtake them, Pharaoh puts out this order that all the Hebrew midwives must kill the first, or not just the first, all Hebrew boys that were born. And then you know the story about Shiphrah and Puah, two of my favorite Hebrew midwives. The only Hebrew midwives I know of. But Shiphrah and Puah, they reject that order. And they say, oh, the Hebrew women are so strong, they have these babies before we even show up. But Moses is one that was able to escape that genocide when his mother put him in a basket and sent him out into the water, only to be found by Pharaoh's daughter later. Next one. They both spend a lot of time on the mountains. So we know that when Moses comes out of captivity, brings the Hebrew people out of slavery, they start their journey, and he ascends a mountain. He goes up Mount Sinai. And there on Mount Sinai, he receives word from God. And that word from God became the Torah. Some of that God chiseled down on their rock. That was the Ten Commandments. So Moses is having this conversation, this dialogue, this learning experience with God on the mountain. Then we turn to Matthew's gospel. We find Jesus also climbed a mountain or two. Did you know that Matthew is the only one that talks about Jesus' sermon on the mount? Nobody else mentions the mountain. Luke even talks about a sermon on the plain. Nobody mentions a sermon on the mount. And Jesus went up to a mountain and he started teaching the people. Now what's the difference here? God talked to Moses and Moses transferred that onto the people. Jesus talked directly to the people. And now we start to see a little change. Jesus is the new Moses, but he's better. He's bigger. He's the next step up. And there's this whole Jordan River experience. And I'm not sure if this is stretching it a bit or if it's actually really cool, but I'm going to tell you anyway. We know the story about Moses. You remember, does Moses make it in the promised land? No, he doesn't. Moses goes right up to the very edge of the promised land, and the thing dividing them from the promised land was the Jordan River. Moses is even able to look out over the land and see it. But because of his lack of trust and faith, he doesn't enter the promised land. He dies right there on the Jordan River banks. But what about Jesus? Jesus not only goes down into the river, but he emerges victorious from that river and begins his ministry in the promised land. And as Jesus crosses that Jordan River, he hears God's affirming voice say to him, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." In Deuteronomy chapter 18, we are told that God will send a prophet like Moses. And Matthew shows that Jesus is just that. All right, let's do one more thing, and then we'll button it up for today. What about those magos? What about the magi? Now, one of the reasons that I think Matthew includes this story, and again, did I mention this? What other gospels do you find this in? None other gospels do you find the story of the magi, the wise men. It's only in Matthew's gospel. So why does Matthew include this story of the magos? Well, the word that we translate here as wise men is magos. I'm working around this backward. We anglicize this a bit, and we call them the magi in English. But the word magi is not only found in Matthew's gospel. The story of the three magi is only in Matthew's gospel, but magi themselves show up elsewhere in the Bible. For instance, in Acts chapter 8, we find the story of Simon the sorcerer. Go five chapters later, and you find the story about Bar-Jesus. And remember, Jesus was a popular name in the first century. It's like Joshua today. So it's a different guy. And Bar is a word that means son of. So son of Jesus, This guy called Bart Jesus is said to be a sorcerer and a false prophet. Go to Acts chapter 19, and Paul is ministering in, I think it's Ephesians, and he talks about some who had practiced sorcery. Now, I lift up these verses because the word that's translated as sorcerer or magic or something of that nature in all these texts, anybody want to guess what that word is? It's magos. Now, each one of these individuals, Simon the sorcerer, Bar-Jesus, the others who practice sorcery, they are all seen as outsiders. They are outside of the Jewish tradition. They are outside of the temple tradition. They're not allowed to worship within the temple because of their acts. So we have this story in Matthew's gospel. And remember, Matthew is the most Jewish of all the gospels. And they know that these magos, these magi, are outsiders. But Matthew tells the story of who's the first one to come and visit Jesus. It is the outsiders. It's the Gentiles, the goyim, the people like you and me. Remember that Jesus was born King of the Jews. We even find this in verses 1 and 2 of our text for today. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." How do they identify Jesus? As King of the Jews. Not our king, not the king. He's your king. But yet notice how they move from there. We have come to worship him. The story of the Magi, with all of its fun stories about gold and Frankenstein and myrrh and all that fun stuff, all the cutesy imagery, all the pictures of people of different ethnicities and backgrounds coming from different countries, I think one of the most important things that we get out of this story is that people who were outside have now come in. People who were excluded are now brought close and given permission worship. No longer is he your king. No longer is he just the king of the king, king of Israel or the Jews. He's the king of all kings, the Lord of lords, the one true God among us. So on this Epiphany Sunday, I remind you that these outsiders were brought in through the grace of God, accepted as his followers, as his people, as his children. What was outside has been invited in, and these men chose to join. Let's pray. Loving God, thank you so much for the gift of the Magi, the gift of bringing outsiders in, the gift of opening the door to people who are not born a part of the tribe of Israel, the people of God, people who are born of different backgrounds and ethnicities, people from different nations and countries. All have been included in this group, in your group, in the group in your kingdom here on earth, a kingdom that will endure forever. Help us, Lord, to celebrate this fact.